David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. So, Dave, I know one of the stories is about how a bird's song changes with its environment. How so?
Well, Rob, it turns out that birds that live in environments that are much more open, say like an open grassland or something like that, tend to have faster and more high-pitched songs, whereas birds that live more in shrubbery have slower songs that are also lower pitched. And the question going on in this study was, well, we know birds living in different environments have different tunes. But what about the same bird if its environment changes? Say, over a few decades, as in this study, over 30 years, if the environment changes from, say, an open grassland to a more shrubbery environment, can the bird itself change its tune to match its environment?
Now, we're not talking about 30-year-old birds, too, but bird populations that have stayed put for 30 years.
Exactly. In this study, we're talking about a species of bird known as white-crowned sparrows.
And there are 30-year-old recordings of these birds?
Well, that was the really great thing about this study. There was a biologist, and she knew that the environment of these white-crowned sparrows had changed somewhat over the past 30 years. And these sparrows live in various locations along the U.S. West Coast. But, you know, she obviously couldn't go back in time 30 years to tape the birds back in the 1970s. And as luck would have it, there was a biologist on the West Coast who had intensively studied these birds, and he had died. But she went to his old office, dug out the tapes, and she found these 30-year-old recordings of the birds. So all she had to do was go out into the field. She took a road trip around the West Coast and record the same birds. And lo and behold, she found there was a difference in the way the song sounded after 30 years. So here's what the bird sounded like 30 years ago. And now here's what it sounds like today.
A little lower.
And a little slower. And this matches up well with how the bird's environment has changed. The biologist actually also looked at some other historical data. She looked at satellite maps from the 1970s and from today, and it confirmed that the environment of these white-crowned sparrows has become a lot more dense with vegetation. And that makes sense because their songs have also gotten lower pitched and have gotten slower, as you would see with a bird that naturally lives in this environment.
The lower pitched trill penetrates better.
That's the idea. This lower pitched trill penetrates better in a densely vegetated environment versus a higher pitched trill, which would travel farther if, say, you were in a grassland. And, you know, just as a final experiment, this biologist actually played the old bird sounds for this modern population of white-crowned sparrows.
So she played this. And the birds are used to hearing this.
Exactly. And when she played that first song, which is the older song, these modern birds didn't respond as strongly to it. When she played the newer song, some of the females, you know, danced around a little bit, and some of the male birds approached the speakers where the song was playing from. So it wasn't just that the birds had changed their tune, they knew the tune had changed.
Okay, so what else have you got with you this week?
Well, Rob, while we're speaking of time, let's travel back billions of years ago to when Earth first formed. And we're talking about 4.6 billion years ago. And this was a very violent time. First of all, you know, Earth had just formed and the solar system had just formed. So there's a lot of junk floating around the solar system.
Asteroids.
Comets, everything. And Earth started taking insults right off the bat. One of the first major things that happened to Earth was this large body in the solar system, one of these really large pieces of debris that was flying around, smacked into Earth and caused all this debris to fly off of Earth. And this debris coalesced and formed our moon. And right after that happened, so Earth is just cooling down from this really miserable experience, and Earth starts getting bombarded with all of this other debris that's floating around the solar system. It's just over the course of hundreds of millions of years, you know, comets and asteroids and other debris are just slamming into Earth's surface. And it's such a violent time for Earth that researchers refer to it as the Hadean era. Hadean as in Hades, as in hell on Earth. And the most violent part of this period occurred about 3.9 billion years ago, and it's called the Late Heavy Bombardment. That's when this bombardment was really, really strong. And scientists have hypothesized for a while that if there was any life on Earth, and some scientists have speculated that there may have been life a few hundred million years before this heavy bombardment took place, that it would have pretty much all been wiped out because this bombardment was so severe, it would have essentially sterilized our planet. And so life only picked up again, you know, millions of years after this late heavy bombardment.
So what was the study here?
Well, the study is scientists wanted to figure out, you know, is this really correct? Did this late heavy bombardment essentially wipe all life off the face of the Earth?
And so they did a simulation or something like that.
They did a computer simulation, and, you know, they tried to replicate these conditions from Earth when it was very young. And what they found was that, you know, a lot of scientists have said the reason life would have been wiped out is because when these comets or, you know, asteroids or whatever hit Earth, they caused so much heat that they would have essentially vaporized anything down to a kilometer down in Earth's surface. But what these scientists say is actually in most of these places where these impacts would have occurred, water would have quickly rushed up from Earth's crust and cooled off the area. So things wouldn't get as hot as some scientists had speculated. They would cool down very quickly, and that would allow life to survive. And what's more, the researchers say that life could have actually existed about 4 kilometers down, which means that even when these impacts were causing this massive amount of heat, and even if this heat penetrated down as much as a kilometer, there could still be a lot of life way below the surface that would have survived.
There's evidence of life well below a kilometer down now, isn't there?
Yeah, so it's certainly possible. And what's also sort of cool about this study is that there's been speculation that one of the earliest life forms on Earth was a heat-loving organism, something that we find some of these organisms today in these deep hydrothermal vents in the sea. They live at temperatures that would scald me or you, but they seem to thrive at these very high temperatures. And what it suggests is that, you know, this wasn't obviously a time that you and I would have wanted to be on Earth, but these organisms were living in this environment that was very hot, and perhaps they were just very well suited to this environment. You know, there's all these impacts going on. Earth's surface was very hot. And it just makes sense that one of the earliest organisms might be an organism that was adapted to this way of life.
Okay, and I see you've got one more story with you. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from difficult times for a young Earth to difficult times for people with cancer. You know, there's been a lot of studies that show that people with cancer also tend to have depression. In fact, studies showed that about 60% of women with breast cancer are also depressed. And this seems to hold true for a lot of other cancers as well. And obviously, I mean, somewhat it makes sense. You know, if you or I were diagnosed with cancer, it's going to be a very heavy blow to us, and it's going to make us sad and depressed and, you know, anxious and what have you. But there's also been some speculation about, you know, is there something about the cancer itself? Is the tumor actually doing something, you know, biochemically to our bodies or to our brains that's actually causing the depression? In other words, can the tumors cause depression themselves?
The tumor's not the treatment.
The tumor is not the treatment. There's actually have been some studies that chemotherapy itself can cause depression. But, you know, this is a really hard question to answer because if I'm looking at patients that have been diagnosed with cancer, it's impossible for me to weed out the effects of the psychological burden of them being diagnosed with cancer, any sort of chemotherapy that they're undergoing, and anything that could be potentially going on biochemically with their cancer, with their tumors. So what researchers did to get around this problem in this current study was to turn to rats.
So that gets rid of potentially the psychological awareness of having cancer and the chemotherapy or treatment that they might be experiencing.
Exactly. I mean, a rat doesn't know it's been diagnosed with cancer, so it's not going to suffer the same psychological burden that we would. But the other problem is, how do you measure depression in rats? And there's established ways to do that.
Really?
Yeah, you can put a rat in a cylinder of water, and if the rat just floats instead of treading water, that's a sign of depression. Rats that are depressed also tend to eat less sugar. So there are some ways to test depression in rats. And what the researchers found was that even absent chemotherapy or the psychological burden of knowing that they have cancer, rats with tumors displayed significantly more depressive behaviors than rats without tumors when they were subjected to these tests.
Behaviors aside, was there anything else that the researchers looked at?
Well, they looked at a number of chemicals that tumors secrete. And one of these chemicals is cytokines. And there's been studies in humans that have shown that cytokines can regulate certain human behaviors. And they looked at a few other chemicals as well. And they saw this real difference in the levels of the chemicals that were present in rats with cancer and rats without cancer. So this was a further indication that maybe the cancer itself is doing something that causes depression or causes, you know, a variety of emotional states in rats and then in us.
What are other researchers saying about this?
Well, experts are excited about this because there really hasn't been much research in this area. And that's because it's, you know, as we said at the outset, it's very hard to separate all these different confounding factors when we're dealing with cancer and depression. So even though this is in rats, it really takes us a long way towards understanding how cancer can affect us emotionally.
So probably looking for a number of studies in the future with different animals and different behaviors of depression.
Exactly.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
So, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into the genetics of the bearded lady. And on the policy blog, we continue to follow swine flu. We've got a daily timeline up, so you can track what's going on with swine flu day by day. And there's also a lot of non-swine flu coverage going on. We've got a story this week about the future of CERN, which is the world's largest particle physics laboratory. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.